loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Today is Victory Day, marking 71 years since the surrender of Nazi forces to the Soviet Union. The Soviet sacrifice in the Second World War was immense, with some estimates pointing to 27 million Soviet citizens having lost their lives. Yet, in the West, the narrative still points to the Western allies as being the main liberators of Europe. We look at the true history of World War II and the Cold War that followed, and the role of the Soviet Union and the West, and we are joined for the full hour by Peter Kuznick. He is a historian and professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Peter Kuznick was the co-collaborator with filmmaker Oliver Stone in the production of the 10-part video series, The Untold History of the United States. Mr. Kuznick and Oliver Stone are the co-authors of a book by the same title, which is the companion piece to the video series. Welcome, Peter Kuznick.
Talk to you.
Today is May 9th, celebrated in Russia and before that in the Soviet Union as Victory Day, the day in 1945 marking the capitulation of Germany and the military defeat of fascism and Nazism. In the United States, we celebrate V-Day or Victory Day on May 8th as the day marking the end of the war in Europe. In Russia, this day is a holiday and it's a very big and important date, but not such a big deal at all in the United States. What's the difference and why?
The Americans and the Soviets have such different memories of World War II. The Americans see it in the triumphalist sense, you know, the good war, the victory against fascism. But the American sacrifice was relatively minimal compared to the Soviet sacrifice. And they commemorate it everywhere. You have to imagine the impact. The Soviets lost 27 million people in World War II. Everybody was affected. All families lost people, and they all suffered immensely during the war. The United States, it was a war over there. It was a newsreel war. It did not impact people in quite the same way, although most Americans did serve, who were of the right age, did serve in the military during the war. But the devastating impact of losing 27 million and what that means is almost inconceivable. President Kennedy, John Kennedy, in his commencement address at American University in 1963, said it's as if the United States, everything east of Chicago had been destroyed, was the impact. So it's such a big part of this Russian consciousness and awareness, hard for Americans to imagine. One of the things parallels I like to draw sometimes is with 9/11 and what a devastating impact 9/11 had on the United States. We lost fewer than 3,000 people on 9/11. And in response to that, we've remade much of the world. We've invaded several countries. We've caused over a million deaths probably as a result of that. What I tell my students is that the Soviet loss of 27 million people is the equivalent numerically to one 9/11 per day, every day for 24 years. That's what the Soviets suffered in World War II.
That's an amazing statistic. If the Soviet loss is 27 million during World War II to defeat Nazism would be the equivalent of a 9/11 attack every day, 365 days of the year, for 24 straight years. Talk about, Peter Kuznick, also, in addition to the human suffering, there's great pride in Russia, as there was formerly in the Soviet Union when it existed, that the Soviets actually were the primary force defeating Nazism. Talk about how that worked. Obviously, that's so different from the narrative in the Western media, certainly from United States schooling.
Yeah, one of the big myths about World War II, that the United States won the war in Europe. The United States contributed to the Soviet victory. We provided a lot of material assistance. Our Lend-Lease program, although we only gave about a quarter as much to the Russians as we gave to the British was still substantial, made a big difference in the war effort. But it was the Soviets who did most of the fighting. Throughout most of the war, the U.S. and the British were facing 10 German divisions combined. Throughout that time, the Soviets were facing 200 German divisions. And Western involvement, that, I mean, that's why Churchill said it was this, the Soviet army that tore the guts out of the German war machine. British recognized that. The Americans recognized that. The Soviets were doing most of the fighting and most of the dying. 6 million Germans died on the Eastern Front fighting the Soviets. 1 million died on the Western Front and in the Mediterranean. But Americans don't really know that history. So the Soviets were instrumental, but the American narrative is quite different. The American narrative really begins with Pearl Harbor. We get attacked on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese, not even the Germans, but then Germany makes the mistake of declaring war against the United States, and we get the war that Roosevelt and many others wanted, finally. But then there's a hiatus, and we don't really think much about what happens, a little bit about the invasion of North Africa in 43, but the real war for the Americans starts on June 6, 1944 with D-Day. Not only do we have different narratives, we have different chronologies for the war. The Russian war starts in 1941. June, the American war starts really in June of 1944, 3 years later. And then the Americans land at Normandy. We push through the German forces, and we march to Berlin, and we win the war. And if I ask American students, that's the understanding they have of the war. It's a short war, it's a heroic war, a victorious war, a triumphal war. And it's part of this narrative about World War II that's so fundamentally mistaken that it really falsifies history.
Peter Kuznick, let me ask you, you along with Oliver Stone did the series, the 10-part series, The Untold Story of U.S. History.
Yes.
In the United States, as you said, the narrative is the United States won the war. But the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union were allies starting in 1941, or perhaps in the beginning of 1942. And yet, the United States didn't open up a Western Front until 1944, until June 1944. The Soviets had been insisting that Churchill and Roosevelt do just that, because that would relieve pressure on the Soviet Union and on the peoples of the Soviet Union. Because if the Nazis, if the German military had to fight on two fronts, a Western Front and an Eastern Front, obviously they couldn't concentrate all of their power, all of their forces, all of their divisions to the East. Why did the British and the American government refuse to open up a Western Front until so late in the war?
Actually, the Americans did not refuse to open up the Second Front. Part of Roosevelt's strategy was to open up the Second Front much earlier. In May of 1942, Roosevelt asked Stalin to send over Foreign Minister Molotov and a trusted general to Washington, D.C. They arrived in late May. At the meeting of Roosevelt, Roosevelt consulted General Marshall and Eisenhower and asked, when could we open up the Second Front? And the United States committed to opening up the Second Front before the end of 1942. Before the end of 1942. Churchill had said he would go along with it, but he didn't want to from the beginning. Churchill resisted, and the Second Front gets delayed until June of 1944. The Soviets felt totally betrayed by the United States and the British. The Soviets had actually put off some of their other demands or territorial adjustments that they wanted because they were so appreciative of this promise to open up the Second Front. Roosevelt wanted to do it, but he ended up going along with Churchill.
Why?
Churchill claimed we didn't have enough transports. Logistically, we weren't ready to do it. And it would have been difficult, perhaps, in late 42. But America's leading generals thought we could do it and should do it. In fact, Marshall was so furious with the decision to postpone the Second Front that he said we should basically screw the British and change our strategy and fight the war in the Pacific first and then come back and deal with Europe. So he was furious. He referred to the policy of invading North Africa as periphery picking. Eisenhower, who led the invasion of North Africa, said that when we invade North Africa, it's going to be the blackest day in American history. So Eisenhower and Marshall were furious about postponing the Second Front. But Roosevelt went along with Churchill on this, not because he wanted to. And what was why were we invading North Africa? What were we doing in the Mediterranean? We were basically defending British imperial colonial interests in that region. And so the American military leaders were not happy about this at all. And certainly the Soviets weren't. We hit a low point in relations in 1943. And then the United States does recommit to opening up the Second Front. And it doesn't happen until June 6, 1944.
But what I want to ask you is why? I mean, why acquiesce to Churchill? Of course, you have the British Empire. Britain was the dominant empire at that time. The United States was an ascending power, and British power had declined somewhat after World War I. Of course, there's a, quote, special relationship between the United States and the UK. But if the concern was the defeat of Nazism and the opening of a Western Front would have been such a critically important part to an earlier defeat of Nazism, why would Roosevelt and the U.S. military, or Roosevelt as the supreme commander and the chief executive, why would he acquiesce to Churchill?
Well, you have to remember that the United States was not prepared for war. It took the United States quite a while to gear up for war. We don't even get involved in North Africa till 1943, both in terms of developing the military forces and the equipment and the transports. We were dependent on the British largely for transport. And Roosevelt always conceived of this as a joint U.S.-British effort in Western Europe. I don't know all of his reasoning on this, but he didn't feel that the U.S. was ready to do that.
Peter Kuznick, let me ask you, though. By the time the Western Front was opened, the landing at Normandy in June 1944, by then the Soviets were marching west. In other words, if the United States and Britain hadn't had the Allied invasion into Western Europe, it's pretty likely that the Soviet Red Army, given the fact that it had launched what was the largest military counteroffensive in human history and was defeating Nazism and liberating Central and Eastern Europe and then parts of Western Europe, it's possible that the Soviet Red Army would have liberated all of Europe. In other words, the offensive or counteroffensive may have ended in Portugal rather than in Berlin. What do you think about that?
I think that the United States lost the diplomatic initiative in this war. Had the Second Front been opened earlier, we would have had a very different narrative of the war. The United States would have pushed in much earlier. The Soviets would not have moved nearly as far west as they did. And we would have a different kind of territorial adjustments after World War II. But also diplomatically, this was such a blow to Stalin when the United States and the Russian people, when the United States postponed the start of the war. The Soviets were ecstatic, euphoric about the announcement that the U.S. was going to, and the British were going to open up the Second Front. And look at some of the reports. Leland Stowe was the Pulitzer Prize winning Moscow correspondent. He was in Moscow at the time, and he said that the Second Front was postponed. He says, I quote, he says, the disillusionment of the great mass of Russian people would be almost immeasurable. The present steadily mounting and invaluable cooperation between the Soviet, British, and American governments and leaders would suffer such a setback as to constitute diplomatically, materially, and psychologically a major disaster for the Allied cause. The U.S. ambassador in Moscow at the time said that postponing this would make the Russians doubt the U.S. sincerity, that it would do inestimable harm. And it did. It did to U.S.-Russian relations in our grand alliance during the war.
Peter Kuznick, let's leave it there for a second. We're going to have to take a break, and we'll be back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking with Peter Kuznick. He is a historian and professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. We're Peter Kuznick, before we went to break, you were talking about the impact on the Soviet Union, or the anticipation by Western politicians of what the reaction would be in the Soviet Union to the delay of opening up a Western front that would have brought relief, because the Soviets had fought the 80% of the German army by itself. Go ahead, where you left off.
Yeah, so I'm saying that the Soviets were devastated by the postponement of the Second Front, and they had to turn the war around on their own. Stalingrad was really the turning point, and then they begin marching to the west. But one of the points I wanted to make was that when Molotov came to Washington to meet with Roosevelt, Roosevelt called, said, after the war, in order to maintain the peace and stability, we're going to need four policemen. He said the four policemen have to work together to ensure the peace. That it should be the United States, Russia, China, and Britain. Roosevelt had a vision for the post-war world in which these four major powers were going to work together hand in hand to secure the peace after the war. You have to remember how positively the Soviets were viewed during the war. The New York Times principal daily book reviewer, a man named Orville Prescott, and he wrote in the New York Times, picture this in the New York Times, says the vast armaments, the fighting skill, the magnificent courage of the Red Army may prove to have been the decisive factor in the salvation of the human race from Nazi slavery. He says, our debt of gratitude to the millions of Russian soldiers who have fought and died in this war and who will continue to do so is beyond estimation or expression. He credits the Soviets with saving the human race from Nazi slavery. It was that kind of appreciation. This is why it takes such an effort on the part of Truman and the circles around him to change the attitude toward the Soviet Union after the war. So that one of the tragedies is that the post-war alliance that Roosevelt and Vice President Henry Wallace had envisioned was destroyed. Some of it is eroded during the war by the failure to open up the Second Front, but then when Truman takes over, it's going to be rapidly broken down and destroyed.
Well, let's talk about that then. Let's get into the question of how the war ended, not in Europe. That ended today on May 9th or May 8th when Germany capitulated. It's celebrated today in Russia as Victory Day. But in the Asia theater, in the Pacific theater, the war continued. And then it ended on August 15th, 1945, a couple weeks after the beginning, first, I think, on August 6th, and then again a few days later, the atomic bombs, the first use of nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction of a nuclear type on population centers or anywhere in those two cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then the Japanese surrender August 15th, 1945. And almost immediately, or maybe even before the dropping of the atomic bomb, we see the beginning of a new post-war confrontation or competition between the countries that had been allies, in this case, the Soviet Union, along with the British and the United States. Peter Kuznick, one of the issues that you talk about with Oliver Stone in your series, The Untold History of the United States, is about whether it was necessary or not necessary from a military point of view to use the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And if it wasn't necessary militarily, what was the goal?
Well, I think we make very, very clear in our books and documentaries that it was not only unnecessary from a military standpoint, but the American leaders knew it was militarily unnecessary, and the Soviet leaders also knew it was militarily unnecessary. In fact, the Soviets knew better than anybody other than the Americans how unnecessary the dropping of the atomic bomb was. And that's because the Japanese had adopted a strategy of trying to get the Soviets, who were neutral officially, want to get the Soviets to intervene on Japan's behalf to get better surrender terms from the United States. And they were offering the Soviets various kinds of concessions in order to do so. But what the Japanese did not know was that the Soviets had agreed to come into the war against Japan 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. They gave their official confirmation of that to the United States, to Roosevelt at Yalta in February of 1945. So they weren't interested in helping out Japanese get better surrender terms. They wanted to get in, and they've been promised various territorial and other concessions from the Americans coming in. But so they understood the desperation, because the Japanese leaders had decided in mid-May to approach the Soviets for two reasons. First of all, they said Soviet entry into the war will mean the end of the Japanese empire. The Japanese will be finished if the Soviets enter on the American side in the war. And so they wanted to forestall that. And the second is they wanted help getting better surrender terms. The United States knew that. We've been intercepting Japanese cables. We've broken their codes early on in the war. We're intercepting their cables. And their cables made very clear that the major obstacle to surrender was the question of the U.S. demand for unconditional surrender, which meant to the Japanese the execution of the emperor as a war criminal. The Japanese saw the emperor as pretty much, we could think of them as a god, as a deity, and thought of the emperor being executed to them was beyond conceiving. MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command issued a report in July of 1945 that said the execution of the emperor to them would be comparable to the crucifixion of Christ to us. All Japanese would fight to die like ants to protect the emperor. And that was the American perception of it. And so we knew that one way to expedite the end of the war was to get the Japanese to change the surrender terms. And almost every American advisor to Truman, the top advisors, urged him to change the surrender terms, to let the Japanese know that they could keep the emperor after the war. The only one who resisted that really was Secretary of State Jimmy Burns. Burns was Truman's main advisor on these issues. He was the leading anti-Soviet hardliner, and he was also the one who was most inflexible in terms of changing the surrender terms to expedite the Japanese surrender. So that was one way to expedite the end of the war. The other factor was the Soviet entry. The Americans, like the Japanese, knew that as soon as the Soviets entered the war, the Japanese were finished. In fact, if you look at American intelligence reports in April, in June, and July, they say that Soviet entry into the war will convince all Japanese that complete defeat is inevitable. And we have that over and over again in our intelligence reports. What did Truman understand? Because this is key to it. Truman refers to the intercepted July 18th telegram as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. He knew they were trying to surrender, as did everybody around him know that they were trying to surrender. Truman says he went to Potsdam to make sure the Russians were coming in on our side. And he meets with Stalin, and he writes in his journal on July 17th that Stalin will be in the Jap war by August 15th. Finny Japs when that occurs. Those are Truman's words.
Meaning they're finished.
They're finished, of course, yes. And Truman knew that. He writes to his wife, Bess, the next day from Potsdam and says, Stalin's coming in. Think of all the boys. The war will end a year sooner now. Think of all the boys who won't be killed. We have this from so many different sources that Truman knew that the Japanese were defeated and trying to surrender. So the real question is not whether the bombs were necessary. They were absolutely unnecessary. But the real question is, why did the United States drop them? If it was not to defeat the Japanese, who were we sending the message to? And it was clear to a lot of Americans, and it was certainly clear to the Soviet leaders in the Kremlin, that they were the actual target of the bomb, even more so than the Japanese. And what the United States was saying is, this is what's going to happen to you, Stalin and company, if you mess with America's plans in Europe or in the Middle East or in Asia. And so that was a clear warning. One of the things that most Americans don't know is that six of America's seven five-star admirals and generals who got their fifth star in the war are on record as having said that the atomic bombs were either militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, or in most cases, both. And we're talking about Eisenhower. We're talking about MacArthur. We're talking about Chief of Staff William Leahy. And we're talking about Chester Nimitz. General King, we're talking about the top American military leaders are on record having said that. William Leahy, who was Truman's personal chief of staff, talks about this as putting us on the moral level with the barbarians of the Dark Ages, having dropped the atomic bombs. General MacArthur, we know wanted to use nuclear weapons in the Korean War, was appalled that we used nuclear weapons against Japan. He said that if we had told the Japanese that they could keep the emperor, they would have surrendered in May and been happy to do so. I think the timing might have been a little bit off. It might have taken a little longer than May. But June, very, very likely, July certainly, the Japanese would have surrendered if we had told them they could keep the emperor and warned them that the Soviets were about to come into the war. That's what they dreaded. And we knew they dreaded that because we were intercepting their cables. And they said this. So American intelligence says that, and Truman knows that. Leaders around him know that. Yet we go ahead and use the atomic bombs. And the other thing to factor in is Truman's understanding that he was beginning a process that could lead to the end of life on this planet. When Truman gets the report at Potsdam of how powerful the July 16th bomb test was at Alamogordo, Truman writes in his journal, "We discovered the most terrible bomb in history. This may be the fire destruction prophesied in the Euphrates Valley era after Noah and his fabulous ark." So Truman is talking in apocalyptic terms from the middle of July. And he says that he writes in his memoirs that when he was first briefed on the bomb on April 12th, his first day in office, really on April 13th, he writes, this was a weapon great enough to destroy the whole world. Those are Truman's terms, not a bigger bomb, a more powerful bomb, a weapon great enough to destroy the whole world. He gets a fuller briefing from General Leslie Groves and Secretary of War Stimson on April 25th. And then again, he says, Stimson says that maybe we shouldn't use this because it could lead to ending the world. He says that I agreed with him. I thought that, yes, maybe he's right. We should never use these weapons. And it was true. We did put the world on the glide path to extinction and annihilation with using these weapons and beginning the nuclear arms race.
The message that you say the United States was sending by the dropping of these bombs, not necessary to save American lives because Japan was ready to surrender, would have surrendered if they were allowed to keep the emperor, of course, they would have surrendered. And of course, the Soviet Union entered the war and declared war on Germany, I believe, in the early week of August or the August 8th, something like that, 1945.
Midnight on August 8th.
Midnight, August 8th. Okay. So clearly Japan was on the way down. Finney, as Truman said in his diary, the end, finished. But the U.S. goes ahead, drops the atomic bomb, incinerates hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians. I think both of those cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were not really military cities. They did this after most of Japan's cities had already been devastated by mass carpet bombing by the United States. I think you said in your book and series that more than 100 Japanese cities had already been destroyed. Had the United States just reserved Nagasaki and Hiroshima as guinea pigs? In other words, these were areas that you could have a clean sort of observation, a clinical observation of what the impact of the atomic bombs were. And then secondly, how did the Soviets receive the message? What did they do?
We gave orders not to bomb several cities. And on our target list were actually Kyoto, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kokura, and Niigata were on the list. And in fact, the primary target for August 9th, second bombing, was not Nagasaki, it was Kokura. And the planes flew over Kokura, but because it was cloudy and rainy, they couldn't spot the target. And then they flew off to Nagasaki, which is a little bit further southwest. And there, there was a break in the clouds, and they were able to bomb Nagasaki. So we did want to, as the target committee said, we want the most dramatic showing of the power of these bombs. We wanted to target a military facility surrounded by workers' homes. And as you say, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were of some military significance during the war. The Western Command was based in Hiroshima. Nagasaki was an important Mitsubishi shipbuilding city, but they were not so important, and they were not important enough for us to bomb earlier. We kept them pristine for that reason, to show the impact. And the people who were killed were indeed civilians. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, U.S. reported that 3,243 soldiers were killed in Hiroshima. and approximately 250 soldiers were killed in Nagasaki. And that's out of, in Hiroshima, 70,000 dead immediately, 140,000 dead by the end of 1945, 200,000 dead by 1950 from the atomic bombings. Nagasaki was about 140,000 dead by 1950 from the atomic bombings. So the overwhelming majority of people were civilians, not soldiers in those cities. But we wanted as dramatic a display as possible, again, to show this to the Soviets. And the Soviets responded precisely the way the scientists warned Truman they would respond. They said that we were the target. The mood in the Kremlin changed overnight, according to multiple reports. They knew that the atomic bombs were not necessary.
Peter Kuznick, we're gonna come back and discuss this more after a break. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today is May 9th, Victory Day, marking the defeat of Nazism in Europe in 1945. We're talking to Peter Kuznick. He was the co-collaborator with filmmaker Oliver Stone in the production of the 10-part video series Untold History of the United States and a companion book. We're talking about, in this segment, how the Cold War started with the dropping of the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Before we went to break, Peter Kuznick, you talked about, and I had asked you, how did the Soviets receive this, quote, message from the United States? And you were starting to explain that the Soviets acted in a predictable way. They had been the allies of the United States and Britain, recognizing, of course, that the Soviet intervention made the Japanese surrender inevitable and quick, and that the atomic bombs sort of the dropping of these weapons was unnecessary. The Soviets obviously took it to have a geostrategic or geopolitical impact. And then you were starting to talk about how they reacted. So just go ahead with that, if you would.
The Soviets knew better than anybody that the bombings were unnecessary to defeat the Japanese. And they responded, first of all, Stalin gave the order to expedite their own bomb project, their own nuclear research. The Stalin had intelligence already that the United States was developing the bomb. But at this point, he realized that the Cold War had taken a quantum leap forward in terms of U.S. aggression and U.S. ruthlessness. The Soviets believed at that point that the Americans were so ruthless in terms of trying to achieve their purposes that nothing would constrain them. You know, Nixon talks about his madman theory. Well, this was the madman theory in effect already. And the fact that the bombs had almost nothing to do with the end of the war, if you go to the National Museum of the U.S. Navy in Washington, D.C., they now have a display there that says that, I'll just read you from their display. It says, the vast destruction wreaked by the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the loss of 135,000 people made little impact on the Japanese military. However, the Soviet invasion of Manchuria on August 9th changed their minds. I mean, the U.S. Navy recognizes this. It's just the American people who don't know this history. And that's very, very unfortunate. Not only do they not know this history, you've got clowns like Bobby Knight, the esteemed former basketball coach at the University of Indiana, who said the other day in endorsing Donald Trump, says, and Harry Truman, with what he did in dropping in and having the guts to drop the bombs in 1944, saved millions of American lives. And that's what Harry Truman did. And he became one of the three great presidents of the United States. And here's a man who would do the same thing, Donald Trump, because he's going to become one of the four greatest presidents of the United States. You know, so this mythology, this is universal in the United States. It's so widely believed. The reality, if you look at what the Japanese leaders said at the time, Prime Minister Suzuki was asked why the Japanese had to surrender so quickly. And he says the Soviets are already in Manchuria, and they're in Karafuto, they're in Korea. He says, if we don't, we have to surrender now immediately while we can still surrender to the Americans. That otherwise the foundation of Japan is going to be destroyed because the Soviets will be taking Hokkaido very, very shortly. And so it's clear from what the Japanese said, but we knew even before that, that the Soviet entry was going to make the difference. And it was not the atomic bombing. So that was quite clear to American leaders.
At the end of the war, in August 15th, 1945, the United States, as part of the surrender terms, which of course were unconditional, but they instructed the Japanese, say in South Korea, the Japanese had taken over all of Korea, had colonized it since almost the beginning of the century. They told the Japanese army, stay in place until MacArthur arrives, which U.S. forces started to arrive in early September, about September 8th or September 9th, and then took over for the Japanese the role of being the colonial power in the southern part of Korea. In the north part of Korea, the Soviet army came in. They left in 1948, but there was then the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. But you had Korea divided, just as Germany was divided. And then 5 years after the end of World War II, you have the beginning of the Korean War. By then, the United States or the Soviet Union had achieved nuclear weapons, not, of course, did not have parity with the United States, but the arms race was on. And the arms race, the Cold War, also had very, very hot components to it, the Korean War being one. The Encyclopedia Britannica in 1967 said 5 million Koreans died as a consequence of the war. I mean, that was when the country's population was quite a bit smaller. But we had a real global war between the Soviet or the socialist camp led by the Soviet Union and the United States. There was revolution raging in Asia and Africa and the Middle East. People wanted to be free from colonialism. The old colonial empires broke apart. Talk about the impact of this decision by Truman to use atomic weapons in terms of as a catalyst for what came for the next 50 years and what we call the Cold War.
Well, the Cold War was a nightmare. We're lucky to have survived it. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., historian and advisor to John Kennedy, once said something quite insightful about the Cold War. He said, men and women, a century from now, will very likely find the Cold War as obscure and incomprehensible as we today find the 30 Years War, terrible conflict that devastated much of Europe not too long ago. As looking back at the 20th century, our descendants will very likely be astonished at the disproportion between the causes of the Cold War, which may well seem trivial, and the consequences, which could have meant the veritable end of history. Now, the Cold War was a nightmare epic in human history. Friedrich Nietzsche once said that in individuals, insanity is rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epics, it is the rule. We lived through a period of insanity at which the buildup of nuclear armaments was so vast that it's mind-boggling. I take my students every summer, and your listeners can join us because it's open to everybody. But through American University, I take my students every summer on a study abroad class in Kyoto, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. And I used to find myself unconsciously writing down the same statistic every year from the Atomic Bomb Museum in Hiroshima. And that was that by the mid-80s, the world had accumulated the equivalent of 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. What were we going to do as a species, 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs? How many times do we have to be able to commit suicide over and over again before we're satisfied with destructive capability? We entered this period of insanity. In fact, under Project Sundial, which is almost unknown in the world, the United States began a research project called Project Sundial. There were congressional hearings. Leading scientists testified about the possibility of developing a nuclear bomb 700,000 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. 700,000 times as powerful. We had serious top scientists discussing the feasibility of doing this. We knew this going into it. Robert Oppenheimer, who headed the scientific part of the Los Alamos laboratory, the leading scientist in the bomb project, Robert Oppenheimer briefed American leaders on May 31st, 1945, months before the bomb was used, and he said, within 3 years, we will likely have weapons between 10 and 100 megatons, which means up to 7,000 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. We knew that going into it. We knew that this is where we were going. And the scientists warned, the Frank Committee at the University of Chicago's Met Lab warned the American leaders and issued reports saying that this is going to, using the atomic bombs might give us some military advantage, but we still shouldn't do it because it's going to lead to an uncontrollable arms race between the Americans and the Soviets, and it's going to destroy America's moral reputation in the world. So we go into this with our eyes wide open, and we are, that's why we are so lucky to have survived the Cold War and the nuclear arms race.
We're talking to Peter Kuznick. He is the historian and professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's also a co-collaborator with filmmaker Oliver Stone in the production of a 10-part video series. Peter Kuznick, I talked to some anti-war scientists from Los Alamos Lab, where a big part of the nuclear project is. They had become defectors in a way, not to the Soviet Union, not to an entity, but to peace. They decided to sort of expose the nature of the U.S. nuclear arms race. And they told me that they thought their estimate was somewhere between $7 and $7.5 trillion had been spent by the United States, starting with the Manhattan Project that produced those two bombs in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But $7.5 trillion. Of course, the Soviets, if they were trying to match the United States weapon system for weapon system, and that's what the arms race produced, they also had to spend almost probably the same amount of money. Of course, the Soviet Union was much poorer, so its impact on Soviet economy would be significantly more devastating, and they didn't have contractors getting necessarily rich or profits from it based on a different kind of economic system. But talk about the social and economic costs, in addition to the vast sort of danger that the nuclear arms race posed to the actual existence of the human species.
Impact on the Soviet economy was overwhelming. I've seen studies that show that 25% of the Soviet GDP went into the military. So in order to keep up with the United States, as you were saying, a vast proportion of Soviet spending went into the military. What Khrushchev and later Gorbachev wanted to do was reroute that money, divert it, use it for consumer goods, use it to raise people's standards of living, use it for education, use it for health care. In some ways, Khrushchev was bluffing in the 1950s because he didn't want to spend money on the military in the ways that they felt like they needed to because of the threat from the United States. You have to remember Eisenhower, who is best remembered now for having warned about the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower is the perfect person to warn about it because he created it. When Eisenhower took office, the United States had a little more than 1,000 nuclear weapons. When he left office in 1961, the United States had more than 22,000 nuclear weapons. When his budgeting cycle was finished, and 2 years later, the United States had 30,000 nuclear weapons. How could the Soviets keep up with that? Well, they couldn't. What happens during the Cuban Missile Crisis is the United States is ahead 10-1, and in some categories 100-1, in terms of weapons and delivery systems. So but when Khrushchev backs down during the Cuban Missile Crisis, fortunately for mankind, backed down, then Soviet leaders, they were never going to put ourselves in a position again where we've got to back down out of weakness. And then the Soviets begin a vast program of nuclear buildup. They finally reach parity with the United States some years later. But so this is a waste. Not only did it pose a threat to the existence of all life on this planet, but it was a vast waste of resources that should have been used for bettering life on this planet, for raising standards of living, for dealing with health issues, for feeding people around the planet. Look at the world we've produced. You look now, the richest 62 people in the world have more wealth than the poorest 3.6 billion. Who could conceive of such a crazy world in which 62 people have more wealth than 3.2 billion?
In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan vastly escalated the arms race with the Soviet Union, canceled detente, canceled rapprochement, was very threatening, put nuclear missiles in Western Europe that had like a flight time of 6 minutes to Soviet targets and political targets included. During that time, I can remember somebody asked, well, with this vast military budget doubling almost over 8 years, the military budget, won't the United States economy go bust? And Reagan sort of cavalierly said, maybe, but the Soviets will go bust first. I mean, talk about that.
Well, in some ways, there's some truth to that. It's not the whole story, of course. The reason why the Soviet Union ended was because Mikhail Gorbachev was a visionary leader. And he could have intervened militarily and stopped those uprisings across Eastern Europe, but he chose not to. For Oliver and me, Mikhail Gorbachev is a somewhat heroic figure. In fact, I was thrilled that the first blurb we got on Untold History was from Mikhail Gorbachev, who said this is a great, great project, great contribution. It's indispensable to anybody who wants to understand the world.
Peter Kuznick, let me ask you, we have about 3 minutes left, though. But so Gorbachev's policies ended up also leading to the undoing of the Soviet Union. That's a bigger subject, bigger than what we can talk about right now, especially in 3 minutes. But since then, in the last 25 years, even though the Soviet Union is no longer there, the Cold War is officially over. Warsaw Pact countries that were the military allies of the Soviet Union has been dissolved. NATO is expanding. The Cold War seems to have been replaced by a new Cold War. Even now, the new NATO commander has just said that the NATO is going to have military operations, war games, thousands of troops placed in Poland and in the Baltic countries, right on Russia's border, including the possible contingent from Germany, this coming on the 76th anniversary and right before the May 9th Victory Day celebrations about the defeat of Germany and its invasion of Russia. I mean, why, after the Soviet Union collapsed, why did the Cold War not only continue, but it, in fact, has been renewed? Why do you think NATO has expanded? Why the new kind of competition between the West and Russia, for instance?
Let me take you back a little bit to answer that. There's a great secret memo that was written by George Kennan in 1948. Kennan is the architect of the Cold War. And he says in that memo, he says, we have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. We cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. As our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. It goes on to say how we have to do it, because the less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. I mean, this was always about a fight between the First World and the Third World. And when the Cold War officially ended, it never ended for the United States. We praised Gorbachev for his restraint in not militarily intervening. And what do? We immediately invade Panama. We soon invade Iraq and Kuwait. The United States didn't change. Colin Powell, Secretary of State, says, well, we have to put a sign outside our door that says superpower lives here, no matter what the Soviets do. And then you get the neocons weighing in. It was right at that point, after the Soviets collapsed, that Charles Krauthammer declares the unipolar moment. Right now, we're the unipolar force. And if you look at the project for New American Century, the people who went in there and made policy during the Bush administration, what they say is that the United States should never allow any country to emerge that can pose a threat to the United States. We're going to be the hegemonic power, and we're not going to have a counter-hegemon. We're not going to allow anybody else to develop. And so the policy toward Russia and China has always been to weaken them, debilitate them, to encircle them, to surround them, whether it's NATO circling Russia against the promises that we gave Gorbachev in 1990, or the new containment policy toward China. The United States is a hegemon that is trying to maintain this position of disparity and control an inordinate percentage of the wealth.
We're going to have to leave it there, Peter Kuznick. Peter Kuznick, he is the co-collaborator with Oliver Stone on the Untold History of the United States. Check out their video series, 10 Parts, and the companion book, We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.